This is Thursday, February 18th.
First question is just a sort of general one. Why don't you just describe to us...
After, in the heels of the Ruther-Stellato fight out in Local 600, I was one of the reps that was asked if I would go back and run. And if I was elected, of course, I would stay. If I hadn't been elected, I would have gone back to California, where I was on assignment. There were a number of Tommy Thompson, Gene Prado, myself, and one or two others. And I had the good fortune, the misfortune of being the only one to win. And that was... I came back in 1953. That's when I came back from Los Angeles. And of course, as I indicated, when I was here, we had organized from the very inception of my involvement in the trade union movement. I'd been in the leadership of organizing groups to deal with problems that we faced in the trade union movement at that time. I need not tell you that blacks were far from having any of the positions, either qualitatively or quantitatively, that they have today. And it was just a struggle right from the very inception to move even the UAW. Now, while certainly the leadership was more responsive, but we still had the problem, and so that's why we had to organize. But, I'd been on the staff, and so I knew, the problems that black staff members had, and so I called a meeting one afternoon out at a bar called the Double V among the staff guys. First said, look, I'm going back in the shop. This is after I'd come back. I was elected. I hadn't gone back yet. But I said, look, we're gonna really put an organization together again. It was out of that. Shortly thereafter, I don't recall, I got a bunch of the guys together to organize, talk about organizing. No, it was shortly thereafter, okay, hold on just a minute. Let me kind of, it's clear to me. What we had, what I really organized first was in my own unit where I was president, where I was elected president. We organized a caucus in that unit, but it embraced guys outside. We used to hold meetings down at the old Carlton Plaza Hotel, in which we would invite other people, other unions, and we'd have speakers and, that sort of thing. It wasn't until around 57, about 56 or 57, that we really began to branch out then, and I had to be president, and I left the plan, was back on the staff, that I got a bunch of fellows together and said, look, let's organize, and I named it TULC, and that's where we began.
And you were president of the foundry unit, is that right?
Okay. Yeah, I was president of the Devon Iron Foundry, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. And the name TULC, the similarity with the SCLC mm-hmm. in terms of name is mm-hmm. sort of striking, and both were organized in 1957, thereabouts. Was there any relationship between the two, or was that just coincidental?
No, there was no relationship, even though I had then been working in the South for two or three years. For a couple of years. No, there was no relationship. Trade union leaders, just one day, we began to give a series of affairs, and so I just one day I said, look, let's call it TULC, Trade Union Leadership Council. Mm-hmm. That was first, and then obviously the acronym became the popular thing, TULC.
Right. Now, who else, what were the other half dozen people say that were actively involved in its beginning?
Well, in the very beginning, Buddy Battle. These were the people that I had invited down to my house, okay? Mm-hmm. Buddy Battle, Jimmy Watts, Willie Baxter from the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, Nadine Brown, Mark Stepp subsequently. These are people who came in over a period of time. Elizabeth Jackson.
Was initially all UAW? Willie
Baxter was from the clothing world. No, it wasn't initially all UAW, no. Predominantly UAW. No, it was never, no.
So Baxter was there from the beginning.
Yeah, Baxter, in other words, I called, there must have been about 17 or 18 people that I invited down to my house,
okay? What about Hubley, the guy from, I think that's his order, for the guy from DSR?
You mean Hubert Holly?
Yeah, yeah.
Hubert Holly became a part. My recollection, Hubert Holly wasn't at the very outset.
Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't at the very outset, as I recall. I'd have to, you know.
Okay. What was the first TULC campaign? What was the first sort of organizational focus?
Well, the organizational focus of the of TULC primarily at its outset. And the movement that we had going that preceded it was really dealing with discrimination in the trade union movement. The absence of a Lily White board in the UAW, for instance, and similar situations in other unions. The discrimination, the Lily White Brewery Workers Union, we took that fight on. Apprenticeable trades, you know, the building trades, that sort of thing. So our primary concentration throughout that period had to do with discrimination within the trade union movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So from a very early time on, you were already locking horns with George Meany and...
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Was A. Philip Randolph involved in the initial meetings at all, or was that later?
No, A. Phil Randolph became involved. I was working on the national level. After we were able to interest him, because we had the only really viable movement going in the country. Mm-hmm. And we then a fellow by the name of Ted Brown, who was the first black, secretary of the AFL-CIO Civil Rights, this committee they had, but he was a director of something, anyway. He was from A. Phil Randolph's union. Cleveland Robinson, we began to meet around the country to talk about how we could get, you know, take TULC and use it as a springboard to build a movement. Mm-hmm. We held several, you know, held a number of meetings over 2 or 3 years, and then finally in 1960, of course, we had A. Phil Randolph here. You know, we had a big banquet in which A. Phil Randolph, we had him 2 or 3 times. Mm-hmm. They had a big testimonial for me, and they had A. Phil Randolph. He was well known in the black community, but on the Decoration Day weekend of 1960 was when we had the founding convention. TULC actually underwrote the cost of setting up that convention here in the old Stanley Hilton Hotel in 1960, and you know, April Randall, NALC, yeah. But all during for the previous couple of years, we had been having meetings, sporadic, not necessarily organized, around the country from time to time with Ted and some of these other Clee Robson, and we'd meet with Randolph until finally we felt we were in a position to get it rolling, and so we must have had 1,500 people here.
Before we get too far away from this. In that first 3 years, what were there specific campaigns in the Detroit area that you were focusing your work on?
All you gotta do is be there and here.
Okay.
Yeah, you're there and here. That's why I brought this along.
Okay. Well, one in particular I wanted to ask about, and I can't remember what account I read this in, but was mention of a 1958 campaign at Local 600 that wasn't necessarily a TULC campaign, but was a matter of some concern for black trade unionists.
Well, what happened was, and of course I got the copy of the campaign literature from that. What happened was that Stilato, who was president of the local union, and because Ballo was involved in TULC, TULC had nothing to do with the election. He merely tried to exploit it. Then, you know, for a race, it was a racial thing. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, during that period, and Carl, I guess, is just a temporary thing with him, but I mean, it still was a most unpleasant thing. But TULC had no involvement in it, even though they put out literature trying to link TULC. Now, much of this was because I had become at odds. I mean, there had been some open conflict between myself and my good friends, associates at UAW about TULC. And the question of whether I ought to be associated, and my position was nobody's going to tell me what I belong. I'm going to do my job at UAW, but as far as out in the community, it's my right to be a member of TULC if I want it.
Right.
So it was all intertwined with what they saw as, the International Union's opposition. Some of them opposed it. That's right, you know. We had no involvement in that election at all. Okay. Now, it just so happens I'm a member of Local 600.
Right, right.
And a number of us are members of Local 600, and a number of us supported, as members of Local 600, the opposition. Okay?
Okay. Now, Nelson Jack Edwards was Local 900, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was he in on these early meetings?
Jack Edwards was another. Yeah, Jack Edwards was in on that. Jack Edwards was certainly in on the early meetings, yeah.
Backing up just a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is going to back up a little bit.
Right, right.
As I write about TULC, I'm trying to sort of sort out some of the things, the grievances that led to its formation. Mm-hmm. And you read a lot about, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, about particular UAW locals where blacks would be excluded from dances, excluded mm-hmm. from picnics, mm-hmm. Where the internal organization of local unions was highly segregated.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if, it seems most of those examples come from the east side, particularly Hudson, some degree Local 7, places like that. I rarely, if ever, see reference to any such things in Local 600. Is that because Local 600 was more integrated?
And then Local 600 came along later.
Mm-hmm.
Local 600 came through a lot of strife during the course of its organization, and some people stayed in the plan, what have you. But at that point, the trade union movement was able to galvanize black support. That I'm sure that was a strong factor in moderating, this whole question. But in addition, at 600, you had a strong left wing movement,
mm-hmm.
a strong left wing movement continually articulated the progressive position on race and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then an additional factor too is that at Ford plant, the Ford plant, blacks were integrated.
Right.
You see, it was unlike any of these other plants where blacks, we had the big fight getting them beyond the custodial level.
Right, I see.
You see, so all those things contributed perhaps at that day, a sharply different picture as far as the cold question.
Because you see, one of the things that happens is that B.J. Wittig, in his book, both the one he wrote with Irving Howe,
mm-hmm.
UAW and Walter Luther, that one in particular, but also his later one, he talks about the UAW efforts to integrate bowling alleys and bowling leagues. And he says that the UAW formed a separate independent bowling league in 1948. And other accounts I've seen in that description say that the UAW had integrated bowling leagues from 1941 on at Local 600.
But the reason the UAW organized this independent separate was to integrate. Because back in those days, there was problem, you had the problem of where blacks would bowl,
mm-hmm.
you see? And needless to say, it was a fairly well segregated thing. Blacks generally bowled in the black bowling alleys, the two or three they had, and that was it. But this was a whole effort on the part of the UAW to integrate, to break down the barriers in bowling. And as I say, at 600, for the reason I've just enumerated, it was much. We started off, we hit the ground running in this area.
Okay. Now, was the problem then, because Wittig says that this UAW bowling league never really got off the ground, and that the problem was that the white members, by and large, wouldn't play in the integrated league. And other accounts I've seen say, well, that there wasn't a problem with the white members, the problem was the Bowling Proprietors Association, which wouldn't let black bowlers.
Well, I'm sure there was a combination of both. The Bowling Proprietors Association, as well as attitudinal problems with some whites. You have to look at the thing in terms of history, its perspective in terms of history. The mere fact that one was organized, that the threat was posed,
mm-hmm.
Made a positive contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because there were whites who did bowl with blacks. There might not have been enough areas, bowling alleys, but there were bowling alleys where blacks and whites bowled. And I know that to be a fact.
Right.
And so you have to measure, you're looking back now, you have to make a measurement on what was possible
right.
in those days. You see what I mean?
Right.
And the fact that the UAW did it was a very positive factor.
Was that a major factor in the Bowling Proprietors Association eventually opening more lanes to black drivers?
I really don't know. I couldn't. Bowling has never been my bag. And so I really couldn't attest to that. And I was president, we had a bowling. I think I bowled half a dozen times, but that was about the extent of it.
Okay. What was the TULC role in the election of William Patrick, 1959, first black?
Well, I think that was perhaps the first most significant political thing we did. The TULC's role was decisive. We took a vote, and it was between, he's dead now, George Edwards, a black state legislator, and William Patrick. And we were the decisive factor in who the labor movement supported, okay? Mm-hmm. And if we had gone for George Edwards would have been the nominee. Mm-hmm. All right. The key thing, though, is that we made a decision we were going to walk the last mile and that the labor movement was going to endorse a black. We then went to the CIO Council. It wasn't merged then. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, we just went to work and insisted that they endorse him. And, of course, the UAW, we convinced them, and they endorsed him. And that was decisive. Mm-hmm. There would not have been had we not... I've been organized in this black movement they had, yeah.
But Patrick, did he run on his own initiative or at the initiation of a TULC?
Patrick certainly wanted to run, but there were others in the community, non-trade unions, who would encourage him to run, mm-hmm. Okay? And he had support of some of the black non-unionists.
Was he a TULC member?
No. See, you had to be a trade unionist to be a TULC member. No, he was a lawyer.
Okay.
A lawyer, see.
So he was never a member of TULC?
No, he may have joined. He joined, probably joined after he was elected, you know, like a lot of other politicians. Uh-huh. But the thing is that we made, when I say we, TULC, I never will forget it, we took the vote on up at the Veterans Memorial and on Warren, and it was a bitterly contested thing. Good and compelling reasons, I recall now why we did it, but we went for Patrick. We put the heat on the CIO Council to endorse Patrick, and we had little or no difficulty with Walter Reuther. Mm-hmm. And the UAW contributed substantively to his campaign. I know because I was the guy that brought the resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No. Now, I'm heading up to the Kavanaugh campaign,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Which is obviously a key event, but yeah. One of the things I was hoping you could give me a little information on, it's not directly related to TULC, but it's something that I haven't been able to get a lot of information mm-hmm. on, is the block clubs, mm-hmm. Which are sort of at this point coming into their own or becoming more and more prominent, as mm-hmm. far as I can tell, in the city's politics. What were they based on? Were they based on working class homeowners? Were they based on black homeowners or middle class? Or how many were there?
Well, block. I think you've got perhaps a mixture of things. Clearly, I'm sure in some white areas, their impetus came as blacks began to move out. Okay. Which is not to say that perhaps they did not have some form of community organization, you know, upkeep and that sort of thing. But I mean, really, I think many of them took on a very strong coloration,
right.
Anti-black. Okay, mm-hmm. But I think the block club, and I've been involved in the block club movement, and most of the black community, and a significant part of the white community. Came about because of a fellow by the name of Mel Ravitz, mm-hmm. who really worked and pioneered this whole idea of building the block club movement. Of course, the city, I forget the name, the city had a lot to do with it too.
Fire,
I mean,
commission, right?
Yeah. But there was a department within the city that worked actively, you know, providing speakers and what have you. So I would say that on the whole, it's genesis was out of a positive nature, mm-hmm. okay?
Right.
Now, Now, go ahead. Let me, I want to ask, anticipate your question. What's your next question?
Well, what was it, primarily working class homeowners or middle class neighborhoods or both? Or
I would think, oh, certainly both, by all means, both.
Were they integrated?
The Block Club move, no, because the city wasn't, the housing wasn't integrated. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't integrated. No.
So were they primarily?
Now, if in those areas where there were whites and blacks, you had integrated Block Club movements. Out in the area where I lived, the Dave Joy Lindex Community Council, I was president for quite a number of years. Had a number of whites who were still in the area. Mm-hmm. You see, but. The integration, and by the same token, the egress of blacks from the center city out in these other areas, after confrontation and all that, I guess when they began to settle in some kind of peaceful accommodation, blacks would participate there. Yeah.
But most were predominantly black.
Oh, predominantly white. Yeah, yeah.
Were more black or more white, would you say?
Well, it would depend on where you are. I mean. In terms of what we talk about as the inner city, they were obviously more black, mm-hmm. And of course, then too, there were homeowner associations, civic associations, what have you, that became highly visible and identified with anti-black entry,
Yeah.
And it took in. Large areas.
So it'd be hard to characterize them overall. You'd really have to distinguish between different places. Did TULC have any organizational links or relationship to the neighborhood councils that unified some of these Block Clubs?
Not really. Nothing of a formal nature. On a given issue or a given challenge or some given concerns that the black community as a whole felt all the movement, we coalesced. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we coalesced. We did that in a number of instances, yeah.
Okay. I've come across a lot of cases and examples of TULC actively supporting the Southern struggle, voter registration drives, the canned food drives, things like that. I'm wondering if there were, what about boycotts, for example, of segregated lunch counters and stores up here? Were those kinds of events going on up here?
Yeah.
What's TULC's involvement?
Let's say TULC, the primary focus was discrimination in the trade union movement, mm-hmm. Getting blacks involved, what have you. This did not preclude, though, its activity in terms of discrimination outside the trade union movement, mm-hmm. And it joined with NACP on some, it initiated them itself, we initiated our own. But there was a lot of collective activity going on back in those years. The ministers here, the Baptist ministers, had quite an operation, and we, from time to time, on specific things, coalesced with them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we had a very very visible presence in dealing with discrimination and public facilities, etc. Yeah.
Do you remember particular campaigns around particular stores or restaurants?
Well, this whole business of jobs, uh-huh. Discrimination against blacks in these stores and jobs, we participated in those. Now, they would talk the A&P chain,
integrate
A&P. To integrate to employ blacks.
Do you remember a year that came?
Well, I'll tell you, the great flush of activity in that general area occurred, I'd say, in the 60s. I'd say 65 on to about 70. That's when you had really, my recollection is, the greatest amount of activity.
Well, how would you deal with that, with A&P? Would it be a boycott or picket lines or what?
Well, a number of things. We met with them. We have educational pickets. Yeah, oh, not only A&P, others. This brewers, we threatened to strike the brewers, and we met with them, and finally it broke through. We threatened, as a matter of fact, we had the mayor, by this time Kavanaugh was involved, we had threatened to
to strike, you know, and picket the sites in the city where the contractors were had their were working, you know. But out of that, we met. We came up with the Detroit plan. So they had a wide variety of activity.
Okay, but were boycotts specifically threatened in the case of
AAP? Generally they threatened boycotts. Yeah.
Okay, I read some of the stuff on the breweries, so I got the sense of that in that case you were also threatening a boycott.
Oh yeah.
What was the outcome of that? Was to what degree have the breweries been
implicated? It's in here. Okay. Oh, all right. Okay. Oh, the breweries, they're, you know, really, I don't know, I couldn't tell you any percentage, but unquestionably, it's no longer Lily White, and it's gone far beyond that.
Okay.
See, because at one time, there was Lily White.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you were looking at Detroit in 60, 61, 62, those years, and you were going to try and sort out if there was a leading organization in the Detroit civil rights movement, would that be possible? Was there a single organization which the others looked to for leadership in
I would say it was the NAACP.
Okay. So TULC was in a sense sort of subordinated to NAACP?
I think we in TULC, as we do in Detroit Association of Black Organizations, have always felt that our interests would be best advanced if we strengthened the NAACP. We saw NAACP as the vanguard of the black struggle, and we always supported in that way. Now, clearly, that is not to say that there's always been unanimity as to whether as the effectiveness of the NAACP on this or that occasion. But, you know, one of the things we've always been concerned about has been fragmentation of the black community, you see. And in our judgment, we have solidly supported the NAACP because we think it's entitled to be the leader of the civil rights movement.
So TULC wasn't competing with
No, we didn't consider ourselves, we didn't consider ourselves a civil rights organization in that sense. Yeah.
Okay. Who took the lead in organizing the 1963 march in Detroit?
I would say that the black ministers, black Baptist ministers, really took the lead in organizing that. Yeah, I would say that the black Baptist ministers.
And the Detroit Council for Human Rights, that was principally their organization.
Detroit Council for Human Rights? Detroit Council for Human Rights, that wasn't the Baptist pastors. Now, you talk about Detroit Council for Human Rights, is that... trying to think. Detroit Council of Human Rights. No. In other words, the Detroit Council, I'm talking, the blacks were really in the vanguard of organizing the 1963 march here.
Okay. And TULC later endorsed.
Yeah, we got involved, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
What was the Detroit Council for Human Rights?
I'm trying to think now. They have a coordinating council on human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what you're talking about.
Okay. I just recently read an account of the 63 march where it mentioned it.
That is a coalition of a large number of organizations.
Okay, just an umbrella group.
Yeah. Okay. It was a big
one. All right, when would you say that TULC's activities and influence peaked? What were the years of its greatest influence?
I think came after its pivotal role in the Kavanaugh campaign and Kavanaugh's defeat of Mary Annie, which would be in post 61, 1961, yeah.
What was its membership peak?
I would imagine at its peak we probably had 7,000-8,000 members, something like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And at that point, were they only trade union members? Did it always remain only trade union members?
I would say that, clearly from the very outset, it was the trade unionist membership that was prescribed, okay? But we've always had the attitude that there are those out there who identified, who are just philosophically, just as much supportive of the trade union as some of those who pay dues, more so than some. Mm-hmm. And they've always therefore had members who are not people who are not members of the union. But I would say that it a very small, very negligible number. I don't know, not 1%.
Okay.
Yeah, 99.5% of them belong to trade union.
Okay. At what point did TULC start out as a black organization, which then later admitted whites?
Started out originally as black. Yeah.
Why was it integrated, and what year was that?
I'd have to take go back and really check my records, but it was integrated because we thought philosophically it made sense. In the outset, there was clearly hostility to blacks getting together. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't recall now. Really, we didn't have any prohibition. There was nothing saying that that a white couldn't join. But we just didn't get out and solicit white memberships, okay? And I guess over a period of time, it was assumed that whites were not eligible for membership, but that was soon done away with, you know, until people joined.
Did among the people I've seen mentioned as white members were Doug Fraser? Did he become a TULC member?
I don't recall. Yeah, probably sure Doug did. Sure Doug probably did. Yeah, I'm sure Doug did. I think Woodcock was a member. Guy Nunn. Now those are more better names, but hell, there were a hell of a lot of whites who weren't that visible.
Yeah. Did George Edwards join? Not the black state legislator, but George Edwards, the judge and later police commissioner.
I don't recall that George is a member, and he and I are very warm personal friends. I don't recall that George was ever a member.
What about Bart Young?
I don't recall that Bart Young was a member. Brendan Sexton, member. Gene Nunn. But I don't recall. You're testing my memory now.
Okay.
That's it.
But I guess the one that I'm most concerned about is whether Fraser was a member.
I cannot recall with certainty, but I would suspect that he would, for the simple reason that, well, you know, because of some political things that occurred. But I'm not sure. I couldn't say with certainty.
Okay, that's right.
What kind of composition was TULC in terms of the different unions who were involved, and which were the, outside of the UAW, which were the unions that had the largest memberships in TULC?
Well, the UAW just clearly overwhelmingly constituted the massive majority of the membership. But, you know, like I say, from the clothing workers, teachers union, steel workers, you had a mix of most of the unions that were operative here.
Were there any others that stand out as being dramatically more active or providing more leadership or more support than others?
Well, not really. Once you became a member of TULC, your membership identity, what union belonged to, really never became much of a factor. And you just merged in. And because generally, we were talking about things that transcended each individual union. And of course, if it was a matter of those problems, we had the UAW. Why we held caucus, UAW guys caucus, and met to deal with that. You know, we didn't involve the guys from other unions.
Okay, I guess I was trying to get in the back door. What was the relative strength of blacks in some of the other unions at this point in time?
Well, it was far less than what the UAW, the strength of blacks in the UAW.
If you were to order them, you know, the top five unions in the Detroit area that had significant membership.
I would think that the steel workers would have perhaps ranked first. Uh-huh. You know, city unions had not, like AFSCME, had really not succeeded in the large coverage that they have now. So I can't recall, you know, to what extent, but But the hotel and restaurant workers, Myra Wolf's gang had quite a number of members. Packing house workers, that was another. Packing house workers had, in this area, had a really good proportion of blacks, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was Tom Turner active in TULC?
Tom, I don't recall that, Tom was a member of TULC. I don't know that Tom was really a real activist within TULC. He was a member of TULC. Yeah.
Okay, if we identify the TULC peak as 1961, 62, 63.
64, 65, I'd say right on up
67, 68. Why did it decline after that?
Well, I think it declined principally because we had a number of successes, and successes in areas where we had competence, but clearly there was a need for a strong black national TULC, a movement of that nature. Mm-hmm. And of course, though TULC in large measure was responsible for there being an NALC, we in TULC really never completely merged into that movement, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, I think that national movement suffered. But that nonetheless did not at any time lessen the need for there to be some really national movement, one in which TULC and any other group around the country was really an integral participating part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly was a contributing factor. I think some of us could see that if we didn't begin to give support to a national movement, that we were truly denying ourselves. Okay, there were some here who felt that that was a mistake, and of course there were differences arose. The organization is still there. Unfortunately, it's not into the things that perhaps maybe it ought to be, and maybe it's part of the fact of the aging. I don't know. I really don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. But I know that we all became very busy. I got involved in CBTU. I'm still administrative vice president of TULC. Mm-hmm. But it take a much more thorough examination to get into all the reasons why.
Why didn't TULC merge more into NALC?
Well, that's part of the problem. We were too successful. And of course, for the same reason that it took so long for the UAW to go back in the AFL-CIO, I mean, there's vested interest in that power, Yeah. You don't want to really diffuse it,
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you, there's quite a bit of confusion in my mind around the whole conflict between TULC and the Metro Detroit Labor and Community Association. There's bits and pieces of materials in the archives, a vertical file, but I have trouble sorting it out.
It was just simple. There was a difference arose, after Jack Evers became a board member at large of the UAW, and there were a group of his supporters who said, let's start another organization. We subsequently came back together, but that was only after quite a number of years. And of course, this too contributed to the lessening of TULC's impact, its presence as a vibrant active organization. Yeah, the split. This came about subsequent to Jack Evers' election. Mm-hmm. And there were differences, and so they went off and set up another organization.
Were they were directly competing with TULC for influence?
Well, I really don't think I I never saw them as a real challenge to TULC in a substantive way. What it did, the presence of two groups, it allowed outside forces to manipulate us. You see, they really create conflict when there ought not to have been conflict.
What sort of cases do you have in mind?
Well, I mean, you know, TULC was never an accepted organization by the powers that be and many of them in the UAW. Mm-hmm. Perhaps more so after that, but it was not. And I would say after they came back together, there was less hostility to it. But it meant that the hell, there's a rival organization, TLC. Mm-hmm. Not only the UAW, but there and some of the other unions around the city that had what they felt some political vested interest that they ought to be able to be serving too. TULC, I want you to know, packed a hell of a lot of political wallet. Mm-hmm. And there are those who who just delighted in seeing the split. Yeah, as a chance to.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. What relationship did that split, TULC and Delta, have to the Austin Conyers race that same year? Didn't MDELCA come after that?
No. MDELCA, I don't recall, but if it was not organized, at least the core was there, because you know people like Willie Bax and all of them were over there. A number of them went with the other group. But
did they leave TULC when they went to the other group?
Some of them retain a membership in TULC, but really their loyalties were elsewhere, were with the other group. Now I don't recall whether they had formally organized MDELCA. I suspect that they did, but it might have been just months after that election. But at any rate, as a group, they supported John Conyers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we, as a group, supported
Austin.
Yeah.
Right.
And
now UAW endorsed Austin too, right?
UAW endorsed Austin. To an extent, but you see now, Jack Edwards was on the board at that time.
Right.
See, and so their group still supported this, and I'm sure that Conyers also got some support from a couple of board members.
I see. So the UAW's endorsement was actually split also, is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, its effect was, yeah.
But formally it endorsed Austin.
My recollection is that they did. Now, you know, it seems to me that they did. I'm sure, I think so. I'm not sure.
See, the reason is the whole...
I'm trying to think. I could. It's something I could ascertain very easily. Now maybe they didn't, now that I think of it. Maybe they didn't. Maybe that was one of those things where everyone gets the best hold. I don't recall for certain.
Okay. My confusion came from the fact that it seemed that the people who are closely associated with MDELCA are also the ones who endorsed Conyers. And
yeah,
also,
that's right. That's right. That's right.
And also associated with the UAW. And therefore, if the UAW endorsed Austin, why were they endorsing Conyers? It didn't make sense.
Of course, don't use that as a general rule, because there are other instances. But my recollection now, the more I think about it, I really don't think they endorsed anyone,
mm-hmm.
as I recall. Mm-hmm. I really don't think they endorsed him, because my recollection, I know Maisie supported Austin,
mm-hmm.
for instance. I don't think they endorsed anyone, now that I think of it.
What, did that create a split within TULC, that whole race, and who to endorse?
That did create a split with some of the people,
mm-hmm.
see, because some of our own people went for Conyers.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, though, went with Austin, the leadership. But a couple of leaders in TULC who did not have memberships with the other group supported Conyers.
I see.
Yeah.
What was the difference between the two candidates? I mean, you recall why TULC went with all, why the bulk of people went with all?
Well, let's see. First of all, Austin, at the time, was chairman of the, what was it? Was it 15th congressional district. Uh-huh. And he was a logical guy. That's terrible. Just logical. Plus, he was like, well, I mean, none of them had anything against Austin. You know, I mean, those who opposed him.
Right.
But he was a logical guy. He was chairman of the 13th or the 1st congressional district. We all had been involved with him. Okay, and so they just that's why we decided to support him. There was no animosity towards Conyers on among our group. It's just that's the way we came down the pike.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I got a couple questions now that are sort of I'm not exactly sure what to make again of stuff I've seen that seems conflicting, but it more focuses on 1967 and
the property and everything else. I've been out there trying to avert it, and I think any of the others who, if they had known, any rational person knew it was going to happen, would have been doing the same thing.
Right. Well, when you looked, in 65 and 66, when you looked at Detroit, how did it appear distinctively different from most other cities in terms of its race relations?
Well, when you say distinctively different, I don't think anyone ever suggested that we had, exceptionally good racial relations here. When I say exceptionally good relationship, I mean the kind of stable relationships between blacks and whites, easy ingress to the job market, housing. No, hell no. The question here, when I talk about it in Detroit, is right in calling today, is that I think that blacks in the city of Detroit, in terms of the economics, were better off. I mean, I think the statistics will bear it out. I mean, more homeowning, more blacks own homes, and these kind of things, these kind of indices. That's what I think people generally have reference to. All you had to do is read the black press throughout that period. Ever since I've been reading, and they've always been protesting some condition here. Mm-hmm. No, I don't, because that would suggest that there were better white folks here than there were in Chicago or someplace, and that's nonsense.
Yeah. I guess what I meant more was that in contrast to, say, Los Angeles, for example, that not so much race relations were distinctively different, but that the black community in Detroit was far more powerfully organized.
Well, I would still say that was true. Mm-hmm. I would still say that was true. But if you're going to relate that to why you had the riot, or blacks riot, that's not to say that this was universally true, that all blacks in the city of Detroit were making it and were included and that sort of thing.
Right.
You know.
Okay. Why, if you look around the country and again comparing Detroit, why is it that Detroit seems to have a much higher level of organizational effectiveness in the black community?
I would think that I think that it's higher now than it ever has been. And I think primarily because of the presence of the labor movement, the wide involvement of blacks in the trade union movement, and in general, and the UAW in particular, because the UAW has always laid heavy emphasis on its education program. It does a tremendous job of providing thresholds for people to get involved in the movement, leadership positions. Mm-hmm. I think that's certainly been a cardinal factor.
So their experience.
Aside from the fact that I said, there's been a much more stable black community because of the wide ownership of homes, and we've had all, the activity, club activity, and just a range of things that I think that have provided blacks with the kind of experiences, the fashion leadership, know how to run a meeting, to speak, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What exactly did TULC do during the riots? You mentioned that you were out trying to stop as much as you could, or at least talk to people.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there any way in which there was an organized effort to try and cool things down?
Well,
TULC or anyone else?
Kavanaugh was mayor at that time, and Kavanaugh came over the 10th precinct, and a bunch of us got with him, and at the height of the thing, you know, when that section of the city had gone mad, now there wasn't a hell of a lot of talking anybody could do. Now Conyers tried that, you know what I mean? But immediately in the wake of it, when it began to die down, yes, we called a big meeting over at Region 1A, in which we tried to deal with some of the things we saw, we felt that were continuing to create tensions. We called those, we enumerated those things, met with the mayor, met with other people, and tried to relieve them. Mm-hmm. Now, that was the kind of thing we could do, it was possible for us to do. Clearly, the matter of joblessness and all those things, we highlighted that, but, you know, really, was something that came after. We tried immediately, as the thing began to subside, to make an assessment, get a wide range of people in to talk about what happened, what they thought we might do to at least cool the thing off, prevent its reoccurrence, and that's what we did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I have one more question then, if you want to jump in with any, but one thing I wanted to get a sense of was I came across a couple pretty sort of unfriendly exchanges between TULC and Reverend Klieg.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, in general, how would you characterize TULC's relationship to the growing sort of black power movement of, say, 63 to 67?
Well, by and large, our relationship with Klieg wasn't a bad one. We've had meetings where he came and on political issues and spoke, but you got to keep in mind that Clegg's espousal of his view on the question of whether blacks and whites can work together was diametrically in opposition to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And there were too many things that were happening at that time during that period, and of course even now during that period, in which, in our judgment, really, they weren't going to be resolved unless blacks and whites worked in concert. So you clearly, you know, were going to have some clashes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the basis of it. He supported all black and all black slate of candidates, and hell, we said that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, and you'll see in here a picture that we have here where we have the posters. We supported I think it was 5+1. We had a Polish candidate, a Jewish candidate, and you know, on the headquarters of it. So we're, in that respect, we're bound to be in conflict. Now I respect Klieg, and I think all of us in TULC respect. That was his point of view, but in terms of his sincerity, we never questioned. But we just disagreed.
So the key issue was separatism.
Oh yeah, that was basically it. Yeah, because he wanted as much for black folks, I guess, I'm sure, as we did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was Klieg the major exponent of black nationalism, or was he one of several?
I would say that Klieg perhaps had greater ascendancy as an exponent than any of the others. I mean, you had Richard Henry and Milton Henry and the others, but I would say that Klieg perhaps had a much wider platform than any of them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You got
it.
I don't know how much you know about the Detroit plan and how that actually worked its way through. And depending on how much you know, I'd like some detail, in a sense, of how we've alluded to a lot of campaigns that TULC was involved in. And when we do our bus tours or something like that, what we need is some detailed accounts of why any particular campaign was started, what motivated it to move forward at this point in time, who were the significant actors, things like that. You had alluded to the breweries, but I'm also real interested in how things, you know, evolved in the construction trades in the Detroit plan. So I guess that would be as good a place to start.
You know,
depending on what you're talking
about. Yeah, I've got a draft. I mentioned that during the early part of Kavanaugh's tenure as mayor, we issued an ultimatum to this trade union. We gave them a 30-day ultimatum, okay? We created what we call one, Operation Negro Equality. And that's TULC. We spearheaded this thing in which we brought together a number of organizations. And of course, the mayor got involved. And we set up meetings. We began to meet with the building trades. And we made some minimal progress. We also, the Board of Education, you know, was a part of this thing too, because they operated the Trombley Apprentice School over here, and in which clearly they were party to the whole system. So we took them on, and this thing began to mushroom. Finally, we came up, we put together a plan that we felt would bring more blacks and other minorities into the trades. I'm spending time for the sake of time. And it was one in which they wouldn't have to go to the apprentice route. It was a dual route system. There were those who really, if they had what it took, the intellectual equipment and the math and all that, they could go the apprentice route. But the great majority of them would go the other route, in which we eliminated the age limit, and we provided with some remedial training and that sort of thing to get them in the system. And we've got it all spelled out. When they spend a certain number of hours, the equal amount in doing certain things, or they can come out as a journeyman. That was about a 5-year plan, and we worked at that for quite a while. It was government funded. And about the last couple of years or so, we had some difference within this body, this entity we had. See, it was a tripartite thing. You had was the black community, or what did we call ourselves? Minority community, the management, construction management, and the construction unions. We succeeded in getting quite a number. I think we made some significant progress. When the funding ran out, that kind of dissipated.
Which of those three, the two entities, the unions, the building trades unions, or the contractors, were the hardest to win over?
Well, you know, it's always difficult to say, because historically, as we began this fight, TULC began this fight early, and even those who had preceded us, it was always the case of the union saying, well, look, the company is responsible. They have the hiring prerogatives, which wasn't entirely true, and the company said, we'd hire with the union. So that's why we got them all, got both of them in the tripartite agreement. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were there any people?
Now let me tell you, it varied. We had, for instance, in the plumbing industry, the manager there was certainly much more responsive than the union was, you see. And I say that, it was. And then others, I mean, it was really difficult to say. And we avoided getting caught in that kind of catch-22, basin. You see what I mean? We just, look, hell, this is what we got to have. Now you guys can do it one way or other. We're going to sue. See, we file a federal suit seeking to enjoin the building trades of this country, the principal trades, period, from carrying through their plans, based, was a class action suit based on its discriminatory character in federal court here. And that was really the lever that brought us together, now that I think of it.
So what year was that?
Let me see. Yeah, I got a lot of stuff at home, including the suit. That had to have been... that was in the 60s. That must have been...
68, 69?
Yeah, sometime, 68 or sometime like that, around 68, 69, yeah, you're right.
And what was the outcome of the suit?
Well, the suit was, once we came to an agreement, we let the suit go.
Oh, okay.
See, that's why when the Detroit Plan came into effect.
Okay.
And now I know what other, the really the labor, the labor department too was actively involved with bringing this thing together too.
Okay, so it was basically a legal strategy. Was there a series of community mobilizations or mass pickets or anything at various points in time before the suit or?
Well, look, there we never picketed. When I say we, TULC. But there were a number of other groups who did get involved in picketing. We gave a 30-day notice. The mayor got involved. The mayor got us all together down in his office, okay? McNamara was then the senator, the late senator's brother was secretary treasurer of the building trades. He got us all down to his office, and we began to talk. And we began to do some things. Now, back in that time, back in those days, getting one or two here or there was real progress, especially when they were a little white. And so we, you know, we worked at that for a while. And finally, you know, we just tell we're not making the kind of progress with it we want. Certainly changed the Board of Education's approach to the thing. We were able to do that. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean?
In school building.
To the extent that it was hard for them to even get in to continue to use the Trombley as long as they discriminated.
Uh-huh.
But the thing was, we still weren't making enough progress, the kind of progress we thought we should, and I got the group together and we started the federal suit. Yeah.
Okay. Was there any one of the building unions that was ended up being more responsive than the others, or key individuals because of certain kind of constituencies?
Well, let me tell you, you know.
I mean, I talked to a retired carpenter once, and he started telling me that, you know, there were plenty of black carpenters out there, but they were only allowed to be helpers
and were rough work and that sort of thing. Well, let me say this. See, we never, for one moment, we were realistic enough to know the political ramifications. You know, guys don't go around and cut their own throat, business agents, right. You know what I mean? There were individuals who clearly wanted to move. They wanted to get this monkey off their back, and discreetly they were helpful in many ways.
Uh-huh.
Okay, none of them were out there, you know, on a white horse, you know, with a flag carrying this thing, you know, leading the banner. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Were there?
See, what we realized also. That what we had to do was to get the kind of massive federal intervention that would make them move, that make them go, have no alternative but to say to the members, look, we got to get off our ass and we're in trouble.
Uh-huh. And just who were some of those people in the building trades who were able to do that? I mean, if we wanted to talk to them, who then once they had that kind of leverage were, you know.
Well, I mentioned the one McNamara. He's dead. You can't talk to him.
Uh-huh.
Who was either the president or secretary treasurer of the building trades of Greater Detroit? I'd have to think. Man, you're going back years.
It didn't break down that there was one union that was had more of these kinds of people that were being cooperative than another.
No, it's not my recollection. See. And the thing is, what you also have to realize is that though, you know, the union's management are generally separate, the building trades had their own man, the kind of an executive director, their own man who really policed or implemented what they saw as their obligations in the Detroit plan. And what the hell, by and large, I mean, they in the union didn't make a lot of difference, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So the question is, there are those, though, who, as I can recall, who really were very helpful, let's say that.
Could you give us just those names in case we wanted to talk to them, some of the helpful people?
I'll give you one. Some of them, with the plumbers end of it, management, oh God, as well as not, I'll have to get his name. I can't think of his name right now, but he's still around.
Okay.
You can call me and I'll get it for you. I can't think of it now. You're going back some years.
Yeah. I've heard the Detroit plan described as the economy, you know, that plan was able to be implemented when the Detroit economy and the national economy was doing pretty good. It was still in the middle of the Vietnam War. Employment was moving things along fairly well.
Yeah.
But as things began to bottom out in 72, 73,
Well, the plan fell into harder
times.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly, if it ain't working, you ain't working.
Yeah.
But the plan provided, though, one in one. If there was any increase, it would be one in one.
I see.
Okay? But when the fact of the matter, when the plan came into effect, it was a depressed economy as far as the building trades was concerned. Maybe you'll find your copy of that. I know I got to write two or three of them around the house somewhere.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Been real helpful.
All right, Jim. Very good.